BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio. Good evening. We're broadcasting from Dialect Studios in Queen Square in the heart of Bristol. This programme is sponsored by The Converging World, an organisation that aims to create a world where everyone has equal access to resources while minimising their impact on the planet. Our guest in the studio this week is Melissa Munn from Amnesty International, who will be talking about their work in South Africa. Malcolm Greaves reads an abridged extract from Sided with Rosie by Laurie Lee. We will hear from Martin Summers, who talks about government involvement in terrorism, and we also hear about the possibility of a postal strike across the Bristol area. And last but not least, Jeff Sparks is of course again with us for his weekly slot of What's On.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Okay, my first guest in the studio today is Melissa Munn from Amnesty International. Hi.
Hi.
Now, I understand you've been working in South Africa recently, is that right?
Yes, as Amnesty International.
As an organisation.
As an organisation, yes. Yeah. We're always there, yes, definitely.
Okay, what's your particular focus?
At the moment, there is a great deal of concern in South Africa about the HIV crisis and particularly how that's affecting women, particularly women who live in rural areas, and they're being affected by violence, and there are general concerns in South Africa about the treatment of people in police custody, people in prisons, and the general poverty that many people are suffering.
Okay. So on a broader focus, a lot of people will have heard of Amnesty International, and this will sort of sound sort of quite familiar stuff. Tell us a little bit about what Amnesty International does and how it gets involved with all of this.
Right, well, Amnesty International started in 1961 by a guy called Peter Benenson. He was a lawyer who at that time... he basically wrote an article in a newspaper asking for a general amnesty for all prisoners of conscience. There was quite a lot of interest in this, and they established a committee to try and define what a prisoner of conscience was. And once they started doing that, they discovered that, in fact, it was a huge number of people with huge varying needs, that it was worldwide and would need a prolonged and long-standing organisation to deal with it, really. It started as a British enterprise, but very rapidly grew. It became an international organisation in 1963, and its main work is to do with funding research for people, activists in different countries to find out basically what's going on and what's happening to people. And then for people to campaign on their behalf. It started with the letter writing campaigns, which simply meant that governments and organisations get bombarded by letters specifically asking for information about missing people or asking about the health or well-being of people that it is known are being tortured. And really, the work has just simply got broader and broader and bigger and bigger. But it's become a very successful organisation and is treated with quite a lot of respect, I think. Carries quite a lot of weight. People are quite surprised that governments and organisations will take notice of what Amnesty says.
Yeah.
And it has always maintained its credibility.
Okay. I mean, you've told us that your organisation is in South Africa at the moment and has been, and you've told us a little bit about what you do. A lot of people might get the impression since Nelson Mandela and previous decades that things are a lot better in South Africa. So what specifically are the problems in South Africa that you've identified, and how are you sort of trying to get involved?
Right. Well, the biggest problem in South Africa is that obviously the ruling government has simply inherited a massive country with enormous poverty and the whole mess that apartheid left it in. And apartheid fundamentally broke down because it was no longer economically viable. Mm. So they are, in fact, trying to rebuild their country economically, apart from anything else. And it has a history of violence and abuse and torture. And I think, by and large, it still hasn't shaken that off. They have made enormous steps to improve the situation for people who live in South Africa. But because there is this culture of violence and abuse, it's very difficult to iron it out.
Right.
There is, at the moment, the ANC has actually split off its committee from Theo Machiavelli, who's the president, because they are criticising him that he's not meeting their expectations or his promises.
Right.
I think that, there are so many groups of people who are, profoundly affected in South Africa. But we are perhaps more concerned at the moment about the plight of women, and those women, the majority of which live in rural South Africa, and they have poverty to deal with, which makes them powerless. And then there is also this very strong patriarchal society. So one of our main areas of concern is that women suffer a great deal of physical and domestic violence. There's a great deal of abuse. I mean, the figures for rape are quite extortionate, and that does include women and children generally. And of course, the biggest side effect of all of this is the massive explosion of HIV and AIDS in South Africa. Women generally, they recently did quite an extensive study interviewing about 37 women, all of whom complained that even though they had education, they did understand the risks of HIV infection.
Yeah.
And they were, and the use of condoms was explained to them. But what they found, of course, was that the minute they suggested to their husbands or male partners that a condom should be used, then very often they experience actual physical violence or abuse, because the male partners and husbands simply won't have it. And that, in a kind of very simplistic way, is the problem, is that most of the men will not consider the risks of HIV infection. There does seem to be a general confusion between what HIV is and what AIDS is,
right.
And that people, all men perhaps particularly, don't seem to have made the connection that HIV ultimately will lead to AIDS.
So for perhaps people to whom these are familiar terms, but they may not know the difference, what is the difference between HIV and AIDS?
Well, HIV is a viral infection which you can carry around quite happily in your body for as long as it takes, really. Nowadays, we can do a lot in terms of medicine to reduce the level of infection and hopefully to prevent the HIV virus developing into full-blown AIDS, which is basically a very aggressive and fatal form of cancer. And there is quite a lot of work going on in South Africa trying to get medical help and assistance, because in the West now we have developed quite a range of drugs and medications so that people can live quite successfully with HIV infection but not actually develop into full-blown AIDS, and can in fact live a fully normal life with a natural life expectancy. The big problem that they have in South Africa is not that these things are not available, and they have made some considerable strides in making these things available.
Yeah.
But of course, what they haven't done is that they haven't ensured that these things are accessible to people. And this is where women particularly suffer, because they have no financial ability to get transport or get to a clinic or to a place that they can receive treatment.
Yeah.
Or even if they manage to receive treatment, a lot of these antiviral treatments require, well, a reasonably healthy, well-fed lifestyle. And for many of these women, because of the levels of poverty that they live in, they don't, that many of them are malnourished, and so their immune systems are in poor condition. And so, they might, in fact, manage to get medication, but it is it's not effective because they simply can't sustain a healthy lifestyle because there's no, they're too poor to do so.
All right, well, I'll stop you there for a second. We'll just play some music now, and we'll come back to you in just a second to carry on. I believe you've chosen this track yourself, so this is Leon Jackson.
Many nights we prayed with no proof anyone could hear. In our hearts a hopeful song we barely understood. Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew we could. There can be miracles when you believe, though frail, it's hard to kill. Who knows what miracles you can achieve when you believe? Somehow you just to run and hide. But if we dare to dare, don't wait for answers from the skies. Each of us can look inside and hear this song within. It's hard to kill. Who knows what miracle you can achieve when you believe? Somehow you will. You will when you believe. They don't always happen when
Melissa Munn from Amnesty International. In terms of your role as researchers, in terms of sort of helping these people out, do you work in cooperation with other people like sort of Red Cross, or do you have your own actions that you can take to get medication out to people? Or
no, what Amnesty particularly does is that it campaigns. We don't actively set up clinics or anything like that, and we don't specifically raise money for issues in that sort of way. But what we do is that we lobby drug companies, rich Western nations, the United Nations. I mean, anybody that might have some say in this gets bombarded, basically, by letters and reports and information. And what Amnesty aims to do is to produce evidence to governments, particularly in South Africa, obviously the South African government, so that they cannot ignore the fact that people are being abused or are not receiving the help that they require. Because basically what Amnesty really does is that it turns the spotlight onto people who might otherwise simply be ignored or missed out or not noticed. And that the purpose of Amnesty is to make these people visible, really, so that the plight of rural women in South Africa becomes more common knowledge, that it's no longer something that vaguely happens in South Africa. It becomes something that we know about and we care about. And so we will send letters to big drug companies and say, excuse me, but, you know, why are you charging so much for your drugs for HIV, you know, don't you understand that there's a big epidemic going on in Africa? Or, you know, we can say, you know, and this is why the research is so important, because, you know, evidence actually has to be gathered, which is then given to people like the South African government, who, in fairness, have tried to start looking at these issues and, you know, are very slowly trying to, I mean, you know, their health education has started to work, but unfortunately there's a big cultural change that needs to actually happen for people to understand the connections between HIV and AIDS, yeah, and between poverty and the risk of infection and the abuse of women generally.
Is some religion an issue at all? Because a lot of people always point the finger at the Catholic Church when it comes to contraception, for example, and do people have sort of beliefs that may get in the way of protecting themselves sexually at all? Is that ever an issue in South Africa?
I think that the issues in South Africa really are more cultural than they're religious. Okay. I think that, I mean, obviously there was... particularly during the apartheid years, there was a very strong, the Afrikaans had a very strong religion, which basically they used to justify apartheid by kind of reinterpreting sections of the Bible to meet their own particular need. And that's in many, I mean, apartheid was fundamentally built on a lie that was created and then preached in churches. And many pastors and religious people from other denominations challenged that. And a lot of that work has gone into changing things. But the particular problem with the AIDS epidemic is that there's a very big cultural problem because I think, and I think it's probably tribal as much as it's anything, in that South African men have, and perhaps I think this is true in other African countries as well, is that African men generally feel that they have considerable rights over women, and those are particularly sexual rights. There are issues around using condoms. Those are considered to be, you know, just simply not acceptable.
Yeah.
It's there needs to be a bit. I think the reason it is quite difficult, and the reason it causes so many problems, is because it's a very, very deep rooted problem that goes back, you know, well into people's culture and tribal behaviour, which is just not that easy to shift.
Okay. Well. Lastly, if people have their interest has been caught by this, I mean, what can they do to kind of join in to help? Can people sort of do research as well? Can they become a member? Support financially? What can they do?
There's a variety of things that people can do. They can. They don't actually have to join Amnesty as such. You can become. You can be on their urgent. Urgent action campaign, which is simply that you get letters from Amnesty highlighting the plight of individuals, and you can then send letters of support to various governments and people in authority. If you're particularly interested in joining Amnesty itself, there are several groups available. The Bristol group meets every third Monday of the month, at the youth hostel in, well, it's next to the Arnolfini.
Yeah.
I've forgotten what the street's called now, but that yeah, we meet in the youth hostel next to the Arnolfini every third Monday of the month. And anybody is welcome to just come along.
What time?
7:30 onwards. Sorry, I'm being prompted here by my husband. 7:30 onwards. And if you don't want to do any of that, then we are quite often running fundraising events. Our next big one is the Goldney Hall Fete, which has been running now for 25 years, actually. And this is when Bristol University very kindly gives Amnesty Goldney Hall, which is a beautiful area with fantastic grounds and a lovely conservatory. And we have the place for the whole day. We do cakes and teas and stalls, and then there's lots of information available for people. We raise money for Amnesty, we like people to come along to that. And it's usually very well attended, actually. And it's one of our major fundraising events of the year.
1 till 5:30.
Oh, yes. And it's, sorry, being prompted again there. It's 1 till 5:30.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Melissa Munn. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And please do give some support to Amnesty International, because you can't see any fairer than to say that they have the best possible motives at hand. It's undeniable. Thank you very much for coming in.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Without further ado, it's time for another instalment from Cider with Rosie, abridged especially for Radio Dialect and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. The village school at that time provided all the instruction we were likely to ask for. It was a small stone barn divided by a wooden partition into two rooms, the infants and the big ones. There was one dame teacher and perhaps a young girl assistant. Every child in the valley crowding there remained till he was 14 years old, then was presented to the working field or factory with nothing in his head more burdensome than a few mnemonics, a jumbled list of wars, and a dreamy image of the world's geography. This school, when I came to it, was at its peak. Universal education and unusual fertility had packed it to the walls with pupils. Wild boys and girls from miles around, from the outlying farms and half-hidden hovels way up at the ends of the valley, swept down each day to add to our numbers, bringing with them strange oaths and odours, quaint garments and curious pies. They were my first amazed vision of any world outside the womanly warmth of my family. I didn't expect to survive it for long, and I was confronted with it at the age of 4. The morning came without any warning when my sisters surrounded me, wrapped me in scarves, tied up my bootlaces, thrust a cap on my head and stuffed a baked potato in my pocket. "What's this?" I said. "You're starting school today." "I ain't, I'm stopping home." "Now come on, Noel, you're a big boy now." "I ain't."
"You are."
They picked me up bodily, kicking and bawling, and carried me up to the road. Boys who don't go to school get put into boxes and turned into rabbits, and get chopped up on Sundays. I felt this was overdoing it rather, but I said no more after that. I arrived at the school just 3 feet tall and fatly wrapped in my scarves. The playground roared like a rodeo, and the potato burned through my thigh. Old boots, ragged stockings, torn trousers and skirts, and skating and skidding around me. The rabble closed in. I was encircled. Grit flew in my face like shrapnel. Tall girls with frizzled hair and huge boys with sharp elbows began to prod me with hideous interest. They plucked at my scarves, spun me round like a top, screwed my nose and stole my potato. I was rescued at last by a gracious lady, the 16-year-old junior teacher, who boxed a few ears and dried my face and led me off to the infants. I spent that first day picking holes in paper, then went home in a smouldering temper.
What's the matter in the knoll? Didn't he like it at school then? They never gave me the present.
Present? What present?
They said they'd give me a present.
Oh no, I'm sure they didn't.
They did. They said, "You're Laurie Lee, ain't you? Well, just you sit there for the present." I sat there all day, but I never got it. I ain't going back there again.
But after a week, I felt like a veteran and grew as ruthless as anyone else. Someone had stolen my baked potato, so I swiped someone else's apple. The infant room was packed with toys such as I'd never seen before. Coloured shapes and rolls of clay, stuffed birds and men to paint. Also a frame of counting beads, which our young teacher played like a harp, leaning her bosom against our faces and guiding our wandering fingers. My first days in the big room were spent in regret for the young teacher I'd left in the infants, for her braided breasts and unbuttoning hands and her voice of sleepy love. Quite clearly the big room boasted no such comforts. Miss B, the head teacher to whom I was now delivered, being about as physically soothing as a rake. She was a bunched and punitive little body, and the school had christened her Crabby. She had a sour yellow look, lank hair coiled in earphones, and the skin and voice of a turkey. We were all afraid of the gobbling Miss B. She spied, she pried, she crouched, she crept, she pounced. She was a terror. Each morning was war without declaration. No one knew who would catch it next. We stood to attention, half crippled in our desks, till Miss B walked in, whacked the walls with a ruler, and fixed us with her squinting eye.
"Good morning, children."
"Good morning, teacher."
The greeting was like a rattling of swords. Then she would scowl at the floor and begin to growl,
"Our Father."
At which we said the Lord's Prayer, praised all good things, and thanked God for the health of our King. But scarcely had we bellowed the last Amen than Crabby coiled, uncoiled, and sprang and knocked some poor boy sideways. One seldom knew why. One was always off guard, for the punishment preceded the charge. The charge, however, followed hard upon it to a light shower of angry spitting.
"Shuffling your feet, playing with the desk, a smirking at that miserable Betty. I will not have it. I'll not, I say. I repeat, I will not have it."
Many a punch-drunk boy in a playground battle, outnumbered and beaten to his knees, would be heard to cry,
"I will not have it. I'll not, I say. I repeat, I will not have it."
It was an appeal to the code of our common suffering, and called for immediate mercy. When lessons grew too tiresome or too insoluble, we had our traditional ways of avoiding them.
"Please, miss, I got to stay home tomorrow to help with the washing, the pigs. Me dad's sick."
"I dunno, miss, you never learned us that."
"I had been book stole, miss. Carrie Burdock pinched it."
"Please, miss, I got a gert headache." Sometimes these worked, sometimes they didn't. But once, when some tests hung over our heads, a group of us boys evaded them entirely by stinging our hands with horseflies. The task took all day, but the results were spectacular. Our hands swelled like elephants' trunks.
"'Twas a swarm, please, miss. They set on us. We run, but they stung us awful."
I remember how we groaned, and that we couldn't hold our pens, but I don't remember the pain. So our schoolwork was done, or where would we be today? We would be as we were, watching a loom or driving a tractor, and counting in images of fives and tens. This was as much as we seemed to need, and the head, Miss Wardley, did not add to the burden. What we learned in her care were the less formal truths, the names of flowers, the habits of birds, the intimacy of objects in being set to draw them. At last Miss Wardley was wringing our hands, tender and deferential.
"Good boy, old chaps, and jolly good luck. Don't forget to come back and see me."
She gave each one of us a coy, sad glance. She knew that we never would.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, thank you to Malcolm Grieve, and more of that next week. The longer 9/11 and 7/7 fade into the memory, the more questions have arisen. More people are asking questions about why the inquiry into 9/11 was incomplete and why there has been no inquiry into the London bombings at all. The film The Elephant in the Room won the London Documentary Film Award this year, and it was shown recently at Bristol's Cube Cinema. Introducing the film, Martin Summers from Bristol's Stop the War presents a picture of government deception in relation to the whole war on terror, and here is your chance to hear an extract.
This is a book, it's very interesting, it's called Blowing Up Russia, and was written and published by Alexander Litvinenko just before he was assassinated by whoever in London. And the thesis of the book, and Litvinenko's thesis, because he was an FSB agent, was that the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB, planted bombs in Moscow apartment blocks and in Ryazan apartment blocks, killing hundreds of working class Muscovites and others. They blamed this on the Chechens. The Chechens had no motivation for doing this, of course, because they'd won the first Chechen War. Chechnya was independent at that stage and outside the Russian Federation. So why the Chechens would have wanted to bomb Moscow is a mystery. But they blamed the Chechens, invaded Chechnya, and there was an election in the towards the end of the year, in the November, which Vladimir Putin won. Now, until these bombings took place, the lead in the party which had the lead in the Russian elections was the Russian Communist Party, which was led by Zyuganov. And what was very likely to happen in the election of November of 1999 was that the Communist Party of Russia were going to win the election for president. The reason being that the economy had been ruined by neoliberalism in the previous period. People had lost their savings, they'd lost their jobs, they'd lost their personal security. Everybody was absolutely fed up, and the communists were set there to be re-elected. The wealthy classes that had emerged in Russia were not happy with that. The Western powers weren't happy with that. So the KGB, FSB, obligingly carried out this state-sponsored attack on their own people in order to start a war in a foreign country in order to win internal power for Putin. Now, it's not just me saying this. This is documented. When Litvinenko was murdered, this stuff did come out. It was mentioned on news, like what Litvinenko's allegations were. I mean, why would the Russians want to murder Litvinenko if indeed it was them that murdered him? Well, that's because he was grassing up this state-sponsored terrorism. And you've got to remember that this was in September 1999, so in many ways, the FSB, KGB were in this game before 9/11. Okay? And anybody can go and check this stuff. This is widely known amongst journalists. It's widely understood that that's probably what was happening. The Western media have been very, very loath to pick this up, because, of course, Putin was at that stage our man, and we were more than happy to deal with Putin, a man we could do business with, not a communist. Yeah? Somebody who will carry through privatisation. Somebody who won't reverse the reforms. Yeah? He's now turned out to be a much tougher nut than the West imagined when they sponsored him in the first place. But all of that is on the record, and it's widely understood. I'm quite sure if the BBC did a film about this, they would be pointing the finger at Putin without a doubt, in the way that is not happening when we are talking about the Bush administration in the US. They get different treatment. So that's the point I'm making. We've already got evidence, mainstream evidence, of exactly this kind of behaviour going on, the state behaving like that. And what you usually find is people say, well, that's the kind of thing the KGB would do, but it wouldn't happen in the West. And I just say, phooey. Right, going back, the Soviet Union collapsed because the war in Afghanistan destroyed both their military power and their economy. And in many ways, the Soviet Union was tricked into invading Afghanistan by Western intelligence agencies. Apparently, in Brzezinski's autobiography, he says that when they heard that the Russians had invaded Afghanistan, a cheer went up around the State Department, because they knew that they were going to give Russia its Vietnam. Because, of course, the US government had always been looking for revenge for the defeat in Vietnam. And they inflicted that revenge on the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So far from being unhappy when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, they were over the moon, because they thought, now we're going to get them. And of course, over time, they did. But the methods that they used are still haunting us today. This is an interesting book. It's called Jihad, The Secret War in Afghanistan. And it's written by a guy called Tom Carew, who doesn't really exist, that's a pseudonym. He was actually an SAS operative who operated inside Afghanistan with what were then called the Mujahideen to fight the Soviet invaders and their puppet supporters. I'll just read you a brief extract from this book. He's flying back from Afghanistan. So the flight was routed via the UAE. The first leg was crowded with Pakistanis travelling there to work. But once they were offloaded, things were a bit quieter. And I was able to get my head down for a few hours' sleep. We arrived at Heathrow about 8 on Sunday, Saturday morning, and we were met after passport control and taken out by a side door to a waiting car. We had a fast, easy run up the M4 into West London, and by 9:30 we were in Stag Place, being shown into a large conference room in Roebuck House, the same office building where we'd had our original briefings. There was quite an audience, some I recognised, Lachlan and John Miley, others were introduced like a US Marine Corps colonel called Fred Fox, the rest remained anonymous. For the first couple of hours, William spoke and answered questions about his side of the operation, liaison with the Hezbollah, logistics and a number of areas of which I had no knowledge. Then it was my turn, describing conditions on the ground inside Afghanistan, how the Soviets were operating, Mujahideen tactics and so on. Late in the afternoon, I got to the opium shipments, but almost as soon as I said the words, three of the anonymous men got up and left the room. I stopped talking in surprise, but Lachlan told me to carry on. Don't worry about them, Tom. They don't want to know about this part of the operation. Now, in other words, the Mujahideen resistance to Afghan to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan was knowingly being funded by heroin smuggling. The Western intelligence services knew what was going on and in fact encouraged that activity. So when we're talking about do states get up to this kind of stuff, the answer is yes they do. And including the British state. This is the SAS involved in heroin smuggling. That means that what we're saying is that when young people in Bristol get addicted to heroin, that's a price worth paying to defeat communism. And that was a price worth paying as far as they were concerned at that time. Absolutely clear. There's a funny bit to the end of the book where it says, the Taliban were a fundamentalist sect who were in effect the last men standing at the end of the war. At least the Taliban are Afghans, I suppose. Of course, at that stage, we were happy that the Taliban were Afghans, we supposed. But now we've decided that we don't like the Taliban and they can't be controlling Afghanistan. So the history of Western intervention in this whole region is replete with the most cynical manipulation, drug dealing, terrorism. And we're now in alliance with Rashid Dostam, who was a warlord from the north of Afghanistan, who we used to try and kill in the 1980s, but now he's a good guy. I just say this is all wrong, illegal, completely unacceptable. But it's all well documented. We're not talking about theories here. We're not talking about speculation. This is all on the record. Everybody knows that that's how it was done. Now, the drug dealing in Afghanistan is another thing that people need to focus on, is the use of drug dealing, especially hard drugs, by Western intelligence services in order to fund their political protégés. It happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Nicaragua, if you think back to the 1980s, the Iran-Contra affair, Senator Kerry's committee investigating what was going on, what Colonel Oliver North and all these bozos were up to, and of course what they were doing was importing large amounts of cocaine, crack cocaine, into the United States to raise funds to fund a terrorist war against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, because they couldn't get it done by going through Congress. The CIA have a long track record of using hard drugs dealing to fund their protégés. It's going on today in Colombia. So the so-called war on drugs in Colombia is a complete farce, because the right-wing paramilitaries, who are the allies of the state, are the main drug dealers, and they are in alliance with the Western intelligence services. So this, again, is all documented. Yeah? There's absolutely no doubt about it. This is what has been going on in the past. And of course, what they say is, well, that did happen in the past, but it's not happening now. Rubbish, is what I say. The real problem with the Iran-Contra affair was that the named individuals, Poindexter, Elliot Abrahams, Oliver North himself, all of these people were supposedly going to be prosecuted for terrorism, drug dealing and murder. They were not prosecuted because George Bush Sr. gave them all a free pardon. At the end of his presidents can do that, and he gave a free pardon to all of them. So what's effectively being said there is that these people who should have been in prison, because these are all capital crimes, many of them carrying the death penalty under existing US law, These people are not only not in prison, they are in power. The same people, the same names. It's the same gang of gangsters. And they're in power in the United States today. They came to power with Bush's election in 2000. They should have been in prison. They're not in prison. They're in power. And I think that explains an awful lot about where we are today.
That was Martin Summers from the Bristol Stop the War speaking on the 5th of July at the Cube Cinema about government involvement in terrorism. You can see the entire 20-minute rant followed by questions on Google Video. If you put in the term false flag fever, that should bring it up.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time for a music track, and I've chosen today Pete Seeger in relation to the sort of political themes that we've been hearing. He was a very political folk artist. He released an album on the Folkways label called American Industrial Ballads back in the 50s that helped to inspire a whole folk revival. He was an unashamedly left-wing man, and alongside other entertainers of the era, received a lot of unwanted scrutiny from the US authorities back in the 40s and 50s. In 1948, he was blacklisted and made to appear before the Un-American Activities Committee, where he refused to testify. He continues to perform even to this day with his grandson, and he's been at the forefront of the labour movement, the struggle for civil rights, the peace and anti-war movements, and the fight for a clean world. He has latterly lent his name to environmental concerns, supporting the Clearwater, a 19th century Hudson River sloop that makes frequent stops on the river to educate people about its ecology. So here's your chance to hear a little bit about him, and we're going to hear a track that's been covered by Billy Bragg as well. It's called Whose Side Are You On?
From all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner and I'm a miner's son, and I'll stick with the Union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Don't scab for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That was Pete Seeger. That was from an album called Industrial American Ballads and More, currently going in FOP for £3. Okay, we're going to go over to the What's On Guide now with our very own Jeff Sparks. Take it away.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 25th of July, and at the Croft in Bristol, Gonga will be launching a new album titled Transmigration. Support comes from Black Caesar and the Sun to Run Experiment. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Moving on to Saturday 26th of July, and at the Folk House in Bristol, it's an unplugged show featuring War Against Sleep, Hacksaw, Team Brick and The Great Park. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 each. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I feature a track from Bruce Dickinson's first solo album, which was released in 1990. The album is titled Tattooed Millionaire, and the track is titled Licking the Gun.
Eat lead, you scum-sucking.
Bruce Dickinson with Licking the Gun from the album Tattooed Millionaire. Now, keeping with Saturday 26th of July, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, the John E. Vistick Experience will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, coming to Sunday 27th of July, and at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol, Blood of Ash will be performing with support from Sharp End First. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 27th of July and at the Louisiana in Bristol, the two-piece acoustic rap group The Clap will be performing with support from Eurison and also The Woods. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, I can personally highly recommend going to see the Johnny Vistick Experience because in our Trinity days, when we were at the Trinity Church, they did a session for us live for the show, and they're all a bit modest and apologetic. Went, oh, well, we haven't got, you know, so-and-so hasn't turned up, we haven't got a drummer, and they did an amazing set. And Mr. Wolf's is very nice. That's why I would go.
¶¶ stands all alone. You can hear her hum softly from her fire escape in the sky. She fills the bags 'neath her eyes with the moonbeams and cries 'cause the world's passed her by. Didn't time sound sweet yesterday in a world filled with friends? You lose your way. She's a haunted house and her window are broken, and the sad young man's gone away. Her bathrobe's torn and tears smudge her lipstick, and the neighbors just whisper all day. Didn't time sound sweet yesterday in a world filled with friends?
That was Scott Walker, still making albums even to this day. He's received a lot of support from people like Jarvis Cocker of Pulp, for example, and that's kind of given him a bit of a resurgence in later days.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that's the end of Dialect Radio for this week. We're taking a break for the summer before long, but I think we will be back for one or two other shows. We'll be back in September. We'd like to thank our sponsor for the last 6 weeks, theconvergingworld.org. They're a charity that raises money to set up wind turbines in Tamil Nadu in South India. You can contact them on their website at theconvergingworld.org, and that's all one word. In the studio today was our guest Melissa Munn from Amnesty International. Thank you to her. The presenter was myself, John Peters Cohen. Thank you to Malcolm Greave for reading Cider with Rosie. And Tony Gosling gave us his two features, Martin Summers and the Communication Workers Union piece. Thank you to Jeff Sparks for the What's On Guide and to Anthony Page forever as being for being generally lovely. The studio director was John Peters Cohen. The studio engineer was Villas Chitchikiran. So it's goodbye from me. Enjoy your summer. Take care.